Hello and welcome to the Unmissables, episode 65, the latest in a long series of probings into television and popular culture, hosted by me, Boyd Hilton. I don't think I've introduced myself for a long time. Have I?
No, you haven't.
No.
You don't need an introduction.
Well,
to be fair.
I do. That voice you're hearing just now is Kay Ribeiro.
Hello.
And in an exciting development, John Harris, for it is he, a.k.a. John Dan, a.k.a. our producer, guru, editor, technician.
Friend, you always forget
podcast
that one.
Correspondent, friend, is here taking the place, as if her place could be taken, of Steph Seelan, who outrageously is away this week. Welcome, John.
Welcome me. Her place cannot be taken. I'll try my best.
Yeah.
She's going to be like furious. But can I just say something about Steph's holiday? She's having a good time. Her husband, Liam's already sent me a little video of her reclining in the garden in her swimming pool. Yes, she's paid too much a bower. She's got a swimming pool and she was reclining, listening to a podcast.
She's got a swimming pool?
Like a
Just like a blow-up inflatable one?
Yeah, no, it's a paddling pool. But it's big, to be fair. It's really big and she looks so happy.
I was going to say, you don't get swimming pools in Luton. Isn't that where she lives?
You can, I'm sure.
Yeah, well...
They have water there.
So in order to deal with the absence of Steph, we've got a little special format change this week. Instead of the usual question time, we're going to do a spoiler special discussion of the last ever episode of The Bridge, which went out on BBC Two last Friday. And we feel we've given you a few days to digest it, watch it, if you're a Bridge fan. If you haven't watched it, then we'll tell you at the end of the podcast when to stop listening.
Yeah.
And come back later.
We don't want to spoil it for anyone.
Because we will be talking about what happens in it.
Yeah.
So that's a bonus. Before then, the meaty subjects which we're going to look at are big new Sky Atlantic / HBO / Now TV crime drama series Sharp Objects, based on the book by Gillian. Yes, that's how
you
pronounce
their
name.
Gillian.
Gillian Flynn of Gone Girl fame. Gone Girl Gillian.
How do you say the chocolate shells? Well, we're at it.
The chocolate
sounded.
Shells.
Gullion.
Yeah. How do you say it?
Gullion.
Gullion. Are you sure?
Well, it's French, aren't they?
Belgian.
Belgian.
Gullion. Yeah. Oh.
John Dan knows. Anything right. French?
Oh, I don't know if that's correct. You asked, how
it
do
sound
I say
right.
it?
Yeah.
It's Gullion.
Well, I didn't want to say
it. How would you say it?
Gullion?
Gillian?
Gullion?
Oh, yeah.
Gillian?
Sounds better like that, right?
And you've Gullion? Got to do Gullion?
In further foreign language news, we're also looking at Dicta 3.
Is that how you say it?
Dicta.
you make everything sound German.
I know. It's actually not German either. It's it's Scandinavian. It's the third series of the Scandinavian crime drama Dicta. She's a reporter, no less. And it's on the More 4 channel. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the Walter Presents strand, which we mentioned last week.
Walter Presents.
Look, Walter Presents should love us.
Mm.
And finally, I would say highly anticipated new 6-part drama series, Picnic at Hanging Rock, which tells the same story. It's based on an Australian novel that came out in, I think, the 70s or late 60s. And the original film, Picnic at Hanging Rock, have you seen it, John?
No, I haven't.
By Peter Weir, the director Peter Weir, is an absolute all-time classic, Kay. You look at me like I'm mad, but I'm not. It's generally regarded as, I would say, one of the best Australian films of all time.
I mean,
it's very Australian.
Many are there? Tons?
There are loads of Australian films, but it's up there in a lot of people's favourite films of all time. Mm. Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Interesting.
So we'll be looking at that, and it stars that one from Game of Thrones.
Natalie Dormer.
Before all that, though, as is tradition, we're going to hold forth, we're going to freewheel it about stuff we've been enjoying in our cultural worlds this week. Usually, we start with Seelan, and usually it's basically a litany of Netflix-based true crime things that she's watched. So I'm wondering if John is going to stick with that, or if he's got his own mind. He wants to tell us stuff that he likes.
I'm equally as clichéd, but not in the same way as Steph. And I'm actually a big fan of the kind of murdery stuff.
Yeah.
You love the true crime.
But I thought, seeing as you said earlier, I am the podcast correspondent.
Yes.
I thought I'd bring three podcasts.
Excellent.
Do you know what I have to say?
Yeah, we're
obviously,
our pens
I miss
out.
Steph, but I do love these podcast recommendations from John Dan.
Get your pen and paper ready.
Right, I have pens just pointed. Right, go on.
Caliphate. Have you heard about this?
Ooh, yeah, I have.
Heard of it.
Yeah, but I haven't listened to it.
It's Believe the Hype, honestly.
Really?
Is. So I hadn't listened to any of it until Monday, and between then and now I've caught up because you just have to listen to it all. And it's great because one of the great things about podcasts is each episode is as long as it is good. So some of them will be 25 minutes, some of them will be 40 minutes. It's not like a strict...
Sorry.
This is not a hint to you guys.
No, I was just warning because I was thinking, okay, we'll I think that's
10 more minutes, give it.
That's John's hint. We're going to wrap it up in five.
No, it's you're the one. You're the wrap-up queen.
So New York Times journalist Rukmini Kalimachi reports on Islamic State. The first six episodes, I believe, are mostly dedicated to an interview where a Canadian ISIS defector speaks to Rukmini and her producer all about his time there. And it's really interesting because it gives you not empathy or like an understanding, but it kind of gives you a perspective of it that makes you go, I can see what they saw.
Yeah.
Rather than where, whereas it's really difficult to kind of understand sometimes where these people are coming from, to think that going to the Middle East to fight for ISIS seems like a logical decision for them. And it really gives you an interesting insight into that kind of mindset and how that happens on the internet and stuff. And it's just so well produced, it's so well reported. And then even after that point, it kind of stops focusing really specifically on his story. But the level of journalism on it is just... it's just unfathomable.
Wait, did you say the guy, the ISIS defector, is named? Right?
They give him a name, which is pseudonym. Kind of his online name.
Right, okay.
But it's not his real name.
Is the level of journalism greater even than when we're writing about like Victoria Beckham or something?
It is. It's
is it up there?
It almost reached the heady heights of Heat magazine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't take the piss.
Sorry.
Not you. I'm talking to Boy. Don't worry. How can we get this? iTunes.
It's on all the
wherever
podcasting
you get your
services. Right. It is phenomenal.
And six episodes?
No, I think there's 10 already.
Oh.
We need to catch up.
Wow.
But honestly, sometimes I worry that when, you know, there's one with a big, it's like, oh, many episodes, like, I don't know, 65. It seems like a big commitment for the listener, but honestly, you'll start and you'll struggle to stop.
Can I just say, brilliant. John Dunn, I do appreciate all the support you give us as our producer. Constant encouragement.
I mean, if you're listening, I would just, you know, I wouldn't go too far back into the archives. There was someone, wasn't there? There was someone a while back who started from the beginning.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, that is dedication.
Crazy talk.
That was a super pog, and we need to remember the name of that person.
So that podcast is called Caliphate, is that
yes.
right? Yes.
Caliphate.
Yes.
Secondly, on a similar kind of, well, it's an investigative journalism podcast. This one's called The Gateway, which is by Gizmodo. Mm. And
Gizmodo.
Jennings Brown investigates a controversial internet spiritual guru called Teal Swan.
So this sounds right up your street,
yeah,
boys.
That sounds great.
So she does videos on YouTube that are kind of in the self-help style with kind of waves in the background and her talking in quite a, you know, calming, reassuring voice. But she has been accused of promoting suicide and running a cult.
Oh my God.
She has a process called the completion process, and Jennings Brown is lucky enough to go and visit the retreats that she organises and get a real insight into what process is.
Is this undercover, this woman does it, or is she invited by this woman?
Jennings is a man, I think.
Oh, apologies. Yeah. Such a common name.
Jennings. Why are you a woman called Jennings?
Well, imagine a man called Jennings. It's not like the best of names.
Sorry, Jennings.
Stop, is it?
Sorry, Jennings.
Yeah, sorry, all the Jennings out there. Listen, if you're a pog, I really apologize. Okay, well,
No, he does it in... He is invited by Teal as a journalist, so she knows fully
so she's
well.
She's opening herself up to this.
Jennings and Teal. Great names.
So... From the perspective you get, this isn't like spoiler stuff, but you get the impression from Teal that basically there's been so much negative press around her that she's now having to open herself up to the press in an attempt to show that she isn't a suicide-encouraging cult. However, some
evidence
would be to the contrary.
What's this called? The Gateway?
The Gateway.
Number two on the list. John, you're getting...
Yeah.
This is a good list so far.
Finally, on a different note, because I didn't want it to all be investigative journalism. So this one is a brand new one by joe.co.uk. So they do a lot of journalism. They do a lot of football stuff, which obviously doesn't really appeal to me. But they've started podcasting, and this is their second podcast following the brilliant Unfiltered with James O'Brien, which is James O'Brien interviewing interesting people. Really, that's also worth your time if you like those kind of long-form interview podcasts. This one is called Boys Don't Cry with Russell Cain. So Russell Cain has three guests on, two men and a woman. On the first episode, it's AJ Odudu, Joel Dommett and Marlon Davis, the AJ is a presenter and Joel and Marlon are comedians. And the whole premise is it's, ignore the awful artwork, by the way. The artwork is like Russell Kane pretending to cry. If you ignore the artwork and just have a listen, I think it's really, I think for a first episode, it's really interesting. I think it's a great premise. It's about men talking about things that men don't generally talk about.
Oh, okay.
So e.g. their feelings, that hence why boys don't cry.
Oh yeah, terrible artwork. I just looked at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Showing it to Kane now live.
Oh, that is terrible.
So you
I can confirm what they're saying is true.
Yeah, that sounds good, yeah.
So the first episode, they talk about the idea that the theory that women seem to be attracted to bad people, which is being very much shown in the world of Love Islands, et cetera.
And Kay's life.
and they also talk about lads' holidays and stuff like that, these kind of things, and, you know, how they can be destructive.
It's really... Yeah.
Because I'm not like a massive Russell Kane fan, but I think this is a really good like platform for him to kind of chew the fat.
Are you watching Love Island?
No, but I've heard all about this guy who's a piece of
Alex.
Work.
Oh, Adam. Okay, fine.
He's like a piece of work.
I mean, to be fair, that could be a number of men on
there. They're all pieces of work, yeah. I think.
Except for Dr. Alex, who hasn't been chosen by anyone. He's undesirable.
Hence the theory that a lovely doctor is getting ignored.
I think that's
these...
more a personality thing, I'd argue, but anyway.
Oh,
oh, he's a nice guy,
friend
but I don't think it's fair
friend.
To say. Yeah,
F-O-F.
Listen, he's a nice guy, but I'm just saying. I think it's too much of a sweeping statement to say just because he's a nice guy, that's why the women aren't picking him. I think it's also to do with the fact that he's really quite dry.
If you like the sound of any of those three podcasts and you think you haven't got enough time to listen to this one and any of them, just keep listening to this one, please. Thank you.
Oh, good. Also, I was service. Getting the sense that you didn't want to continue talking about Love Island.
Oh, we can talk. I mean, but I mean, you will be talking to two people who
don't watch
have
it.
A vague idea of the concept.
Yeah,
fair
good
enough.
Point. Well
Hang
made. Yeah, you can talk about Love Island to your heart's content in your segment. Okay, is that thank you, John.
Yeah, they were great suggestions.
Have you got anything else apart from that? Have you delved into any other cultural artifacts apart from that? No, that's enough. Don't get me wrong. That's more than enough.
He's all about.
But I'm just checking
quality.
But he'd finished. I was just checking that he'd finished his segment.
Oh, okay. Curses.
Everything else I've been watching and consuming has already been discussed on this podcast, e.g., Atlanta and.
Oh yeah. Are you liking it?
Yeah, it's brilliant. And Friday Night Dinner, etc. So.
Good. Just checking. So, Kay. Tell us about your things this week.
I will do, as Boyd is munching on a biscuit. Is it nice?
It's very nice, yeah. It's one of the delicious lemon curd biscuits I got from Fortnum & Mason when I did an event there the other week.
You're so swanky. There's no rich tea biscuits for Boyd Hilton.
No.
No, no. Okay, first thing I want to tell you about is this book here that I'm holding up by Simon Rich called Hits and Misses, which he's like... one of my favourite authors. I think you've probably heard me talk about him before,
I certainly
Boyd.
Have.
If you don't know him, he's a young New Yorker novelist. He's done TV shows actually based on his books. The first book I read of his was called Elliot Allagash in 2010. And he has written for Saturday Night Live, The Simpsons. And he's just a very, very funny guy. The stuff he writes is quite surreal, and this is a new anthology of short stories. I haven't got that far into it, but the PR sent it to me because she knows I'm such a massive fan, and actually I shouldn't say too much because it's out at the end of July and shouldn't properly review it. But God, Boyd, yeah. I'm a first aider.
Is it embargoed?
Yeah, it is.
No.
It is embargoed, but I just wanted to tell you that I started reading it, and I wanted to tell you about it because I will be reviewing it once the embargo's lifted, but I wanted to say that if anyone is looking for a new author to try out, please do try him out. Simon Rich, his book Elliot Allagash is out, and then also he's got Man Seeking Woman based on The Last Girlfriend on Earth, so that was the TV show. Did you ever see that?
Man Seeking Woman? Oh, yeah, it's a good
Woman?
Show, yeah. It's on... It's on the Dave Channel in this country.
And he's also got Miracle Workers, which they're filming now with Daniel Radcliffe and Steve Buscemi.
Wow.
Based on What in God's Name. Described him as an author by Matt Haig as the funniest writer alive. So that gives you enough that you need to know. His new book's out end of July, but go to Google and search what else he's got and start reading it so that we can discuss. Okay, so that's the first thing I wanted to tell you about. Second thing I wanted to tell you about is Sacred Games, right, which is a new Netflix series thriller set in Bombay, which is obviously why I like it, being of Indian heritage. You know, I like to champion a good Indian drama.
We didn't know that, but we do now.
Indian Summers.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. The listeners will know that because that was probably like 5 years ago on Channel 4 before the podcast existed.
I think we discussed it on the podcast.
You need some.
Oh, I've got vague memories.
Really?
Yes, John Dan,
no.
My defender. Yes.
I mean, we've been doing it for 10 years,
haven't
we?
God.
that long?
Yeah. So anyway,
summer seems like decades ago.
I'm so furious that got cancelled. I really liked it. Yeah. Why did
you're
you not like it?
You're its main champion, I think.
Yeah, your Twitter campaign didn't really.
No.
Well, the only thing I was a bit angry about is that even though it was set in India, it was actually filmed in Malaysia or something.
Oh, wow.
You know.
Yeah. Disgrace.
Did you tell?
One of those. No, I mean, I couldn't.
I hope this thing is set filmed in India.
It is, right, yeah. So it's set in Bombay and it is based on the book by Vikram Chandra, 2006 book. And it's about a police officer called Sartaj who. Sartaj? I don't know if I'm saying that right, played by Saif Ali Khan. And he's like this really upstanding police officer whose dad also was a police officer. And he's very much by the book, flying in the face of the corrupt police in Bombay. And he gets this phone call from a supposed voice of God, this guy who's giving him a tip off, going, look, I'll give you the biggest tip of your career, how you can find this criminal overlord called Ganesh. And it's like this cat and mouse game for him to try and find this guy who says within 25 days, everything's going to go to shit, basically. And yeah, it's really good. It's really thrilling. Bombay's a very cinematic place to film anyway because of all the colours and, you know, it's just a beautiful city and it's got so much going on. And it's enough intriguing for me to want to tune into the second episode. I think it's really good.
When's it on Netflix?
It's on the 7th of July. It's going to plonk.
Yeah.
Tune in. I think we should be supporting the like Indian dramas.
Boyd and I were very excitedly nodding our heads throughout your description, particularly the voice of God.
Yeah, voice premise. Of God,
without doubt.
And so it's going to be connected to the police officer's father and Ganesh, this guy, this criminal overlord. There's a connection and it's like intriguing as to how it all kind of ties in.
Have you only seen the first episode?
Yeah.
Okay. And you're definitely
I'm definitely tuning in the second one because I want to see what the connection is.
Ah.
Mm. So that's that. And then finally, I just wanted to do a bit of like some name dropping.
Oh, God.
No, it's not exclusive to you, Boyd.
Oh, dear.
I want to get a bit bongtastic. I went to the set visit of A League of Their Own last week. John Dan, did you watch it?
No, for my sins.
What?
I've heard it. Well, you guys all love it.
Excellent.
It's one of the few shows that you all three absolutely adore.
We all love it. And as you know, well, you might not know, Jack Whitehall has left.
Yes, Ramesh.
Our friend, the unmissable podcast friend, Ramesh.
Kay's, the love of Kay's life.
I mean, you're starting to look. Is he? Oh, you again. You all right?
No. First of all, he's not. There's nothing untoward going on, as I pointed out last week. I said, you know, he's a very good interviewee, actually. And no, he hasn't got an injunction out against me. But they were all there. James Corden, Freddie Flintoff, Jamie Redknapp, and Ramesh was there. And they, because the success of the show is based on their dynamics and the chemistry, right? And so with Jack leaving, everyone was wondering, look, will this work? But I'm here to say that actually the chemistry is just fine with Ramesh. They were getting on famously, filming the next series, and also they've just done the road trip.
Who do you think is more busy, James Corden or Ramesh Ranganathan?
I think Ramesh is. He's so busy this year. What do you think, Boydo? It's a tough call.
It's a tough call, yeah. I mean, Corden does 4 shows every week, plus League of Their Own, which is filming at the moment in this country, as you've confirmed, because you went to see him.
Confirmed, I saw it with my eyes.
And he also managed to fit film appearances in like Ocean's 8, but then Ramesh Ranganathan, as you know, because you are his correspondent.
Yep.
On Earth, has what, 4, 3, 4, 5?
Oh God, I think it's like more, yeah.
10?
Well, he's got the thing on Showtime. He's got loads.
Just Another Immigrant.
Thing on BBC Two. Thing on Dave.
Yep, he's got the Judge Ramesh, Misadventures thing of Ramesh Ranganathan.
Incredible.
Loads of stuff. And also
podcast called Hip Hop Saved My Life for the people listening last week.
Absolutely. And more importantly, I'd say, he's got the Heat interview out today.
Oh.
With yours truly. So, I mean, that surely is the pinnacle of his career.
Journalism. Forget bloody, you know, people investigating caliphates.
Yeah.
And weird cults. Kay probing Ramesh Ranganathan. That's your journalism right there. I've actually read it. It's excent. It's very funny, very entertaining.
Wasn't James Corden the big interview?
That was last week. Yeah.
We're just working our way through the League of Their Own.
Busiest man.
Mm. I mean, it's difficult to say which one's a better piece. But
I can. It's mine. Anyway, Boydo.
Bold. Oh, thanks.
What have you been watching?
Very brief. Well, this I thought I'd mention a show that went out last Thursday after the frankly tedious England game on television, which England didn't need to win. It was fine. They've got through to the next round. In fact, they're playing tonight, if you're listening to this on Tuesday, when the podcast comes out. If you're listening to it any other time, then you'll have known what happens when England play
that Colombia. Thursday game was boring.
It was boring. But afterwards, they had this experiment, this television experiment, in which Good Evening Britain, Kay, which you weren't watching, I know, because you were distracted by that Love Island BS on ITV2. But Good Evening Britain was a one-off experiment into television in which the Good Morning Britain team of Susanna and Piers Morgan presented...
Susanna Reid.
Reid, thank you. A weird kind of mishmash of the kind of thing they do on that show, like interviews with politicians. So Jeremy Corbyn was on it, for example, with celebrity interviews, Pamela Anderson, with Danny Dyer, with like analysis of the football, mainly Piers Morgan complaining about it because England lost. It was a real... And I feel like we have to...
Point?
I have to express that it was... barely any point. And the whole thing was a complete car crash as far as I'm concerned. I mean...
Wow. These are bold words, boys.
I thought it was terrible. But all I'd say is... I mean, partly because, obviously, my aversion to Piers sitting there pontificating and dominating and not hardly letting Susanna get a word in is really irritating. But the whole thing was saved, as everyone must know by now, by Danny Dyer, who was incredible and is brilliant and funny and talking about, you know... telling Piers what an idiot is for dismissing everyone on Love Island as being an idiot and saying, you know, obviously his daughter's on it, but they're not idiots. And explaining why reality TV as a career now is a valid career path for young people, which I thought was a really good point. Because people have always, you know, Piers did
dismissive.
That pointless, you know, cliched, disparaging thing about people without talent wanting you to be famous. Now, I'm sorry, but people without talent have been famous for as long as time. It's just one of those things that happens. Anyway, it was saved by Danny Dyer's appearance and particularly him calling David Cameron a twat twice.
Not once, but twice.
Not once, but twice. You'll have all seen it on YouTube if you haven't seen it then.
When you're watching that clip on YouTube, can I just say, please do just watch Pamela Anderson's face.
Yeah.
Because when Danny Dyer's talking, he gets so obviously so het up and stuff. And she's just kind of like, she's bouncing along with him, but kind of a bit, you know, bewildered what's going on.
Totally bewildered. And it was just an extraordinary television, but... What I thought was really funny at the end of it is everyone's going, I was looking at, you know, on Twitter and social media, everyone's going, oh, you know, they should bring this back. Just with Danny Dyer, though. Not with Piers Morgan.
Oh, my God.
Just Danny Dyer, the show.
That I would watch.
In the evening on ITV. That would be great. No one needs him.
He needs to be on more stuff.
Yeah, he needs to be on more stuff. But he was absolutely brilliant.
Maybe I'll see if he can come on the podcast.
Well, yeah, there's another one. He could be our EastEnders special, reality TV special, reality TV. Who knows? Whatever, yeah.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. And then the only other thing I was going to say is it's a Netflix thing. But it's not true crime.
Okay.
It's what not it? A new big new drama series in 10 parts. It's a one-off comedy special called Nanette. Oh, just hit that thing. Called Nanette by Hannah Gadsby. Has anyone heard of this?
No.
Honestly, it's already Nanette. Causing huge waves in the pop culture world, particularly in America and Australia. She's Australian. She's an Australian stand-up who... You might recognise it. Do you remember it was an Australian show called Please Like Me that I repeatedly reviewed in Heat magazine, if you're a reader of that very tome? And I can't remember whether we did it on this show. It might have been before our time, but it's all a blur. It was a really funny Australian, like, half-hour comedy. It's on Amazon Prime if you want to see it. It's still there. Please Like Me. And she played this kind of very weird, outsidery character in it. She was brilliant. But she's a stand-up. But what this show is, it's one of the most incredible hours of stand-up comedy you'll ever see. She's Australian. She's at one point she talks about how she had to leave Tasmania, where she comes from, because she's a lesbian. And in that place, in Tasmania, being gay was illegal until, get this,
what?
1997.
What?
Yes. Think about that for a minute. Now, this is just one. So the first half of it, I would say, is a fairly kind of standard stand-up. You know, she's talking about stuff she's endured in life in a very funny way. She's really funny. She's
how
brilliantly
old is she,
funny.
Roughly. Is she in her 30s?
Maybe. It's brilliantly funny, and she's fairly, you know, she's a really accomplished, hilarious, very clever stand-up. Then she kind of suddenly does a switch, and she literally says to the audience, I'm paraphrasing, you know, I'm doing all this material, it's my normal self-deprecating thing, but it's material in which I make fun of myself, and, you know, but actually, the truth is, that when you're being self-deprecating and you're a marginal member of society, that's not going to work for me anymore because I'm taking my power away from myself. And she basically has this kind of incredible
switch. Like confessional,
Where and then the second half of it is much more serious, but not always laced with humour, but kind of talking about in a kind of revelatory way the impact that the things she's had to endure as like a lesbian, a gay woman growing up in her world, and what she's endured as a woman, and how women endure of objectification. It's a whole thing, honestly. It's difficult to explain. You have to see it. But it's so bold.
Different. What's the comedian's name?
Hannah Gadsby.
Then why is it called Nanette?
Oh, you'll see.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's one of the most unique things out there. So, yeah, and already, like, you know, people like in America, The New Yorker, and are picking up on it, and everyone. And it is the thing that you kind of have to see right now on Netflix.
Boy, do you know what? And this is an absolute credit to you. I'm writing that on the list that I put John Dan's suggestion.
Wow.
I
mean,
it's going down.
That's up there.
It's going down on the list. There.
If Boyd's glowing review wasn't enough, I believe that won the Edinburgh Comedy Award alongside John Robbins' show last year.
Did it?
Really?
I didn't know that. Oh, my God. What an idiot.
With all the facts. John, with all the facts.
Totally on it. There you go. Now I think it is time for the meat.
Oh, no.
No, it's not. No. Now I think it's time for the tweet. For?
The meat. Oh, Boyd, you lured me in. I thought you were suddenly, because Steph wasn't here, starting to pick off
confusing.
The week, and you thought you were going to get through this without any tweetage. Well, no. Right.
Never.
Well, actually, it's slim. It's
some
a shaving.
Pickings.
It's a shaving.
Okay.
Today. We've just got one message that I wanted to read out from Basilons, at Basilons. And he said, following the recommendation from the good people at Unmissable Podcast, I'm catching up with Goliath on Amazon Prime, and man, it's so good. Which is really, that's Steph's tip, right? We reviewed it on the show, and then she said she'd gone back and watched it all, and she was really raving about it. And then Goliath, their official Twitter handle, got involved and said, good on you, Unmissable Podcast.
The official Goliath.
Yeah.
Goliath TV.
Yeah.
Goliath, I'm just being stupid. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's good.
So that's what I'd say. So thanks for taking our recommendation on board and tweeting about it.
I think we've officially championed Goliath.
We have.
It's official.
It's official.
Whilst I have time behind this microphone and it's tweet before the meet, I'd like to give my side of
it's very somber voice.
The menu gate story.
Oh, God, please.
Oh, menu gate 2018.
Yeah,
in which you
go
were,
on.
Just to summarise, John Dan was sacked. And then for at least 4 or 5 hours, rudderless we were. And then he was reinstated because Boyd staged an intervention.
Wow.
And then it transpired that I'd got stuff a bit wrong. And then we blamed one of our pogs. Right, that's where we are at.
Yeah. I mean, mostly fair. I just want to say that I feel like we were too quick to throw our listener under the metaphorical bus. And I feel like, you know, maybe some of the blame should sit at the door of Steph and Kay for so excitedly firing me and trying to break me down on Twitter.
Yeah. What?
So
wait a minute, John.
I've never seen that side of you. Well, I have, but
I am absolutely furious about this. What the hell? Now, just quick, I mean, we don't want to spend too much time on this, but what I would say, right, is I thought the episode hadn't gone up and I thought this is what had happened.
The episode always goes up, with exception of maybe.
And I thought,
next week,
I thought it was the wrong menu. That's it.
About.
I thought it was the wrong menu, and that's what our lovely pog was telling us. And as it turned out, it wasn't. It was that you hadn't put the menu up.
Yeah.
So who's to blame? You're saying I'm to blame.
Well, I mean, ultimately,
just by your rush to judgment, I think. Yeah.
But I'm sorry, but if a Mr. so he had to be sacked.
I'm also still to blame for not getting the menu up in time. It already.
I think we need to do a poll because I think you were. It was absolutely right to sack you, and then
We'll put your name,
you
and Steph, and then we'll put me, and whoever gets the most votes is officially fired.
No, I would like a split vote. No, I'd like a split vote because
that's dangerous.
What I would say is I did fire John Dan, but it was Steph, and I'm saying this, and it's a fact that she was the one who wanted to break your spirit. I didn't actually say, you know, she called for all the pogs to break your spirit, and I just said, let's just fire him for being rubbish.
Can we have a fourth option that's let's just be friends?
Okay, all right. Yeah, cool. You, me, Steph on the poll, and then let's just be friends. And we'll see who wins.
Boyd's always safe.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God.
He's the one who got you reinstated.
I mean, for the moment. Yeah, I'll be surprised if you
okay,
mean
so
girls.
We're sort of apologising. You're apologising to...
I'm apologising to every single person who follows us on Twitter for not getting that menu up quickly enough.
Good. So he's recognising his faults.
You are a hero.
Thank you.
Let's move on to the. Can we move on to the meat now? Okay.
Yeah, that's
fine. Is tweets before the meet officially? Is that segment officially been dealt with?
I mean, we've had John and I have just had a little bit of falling out. I think it's best to move on.
Oh yeah, let's move on. Sharp Objects was the novel by Gillian Flynn. of Gone Girl fame. One of my favourite films of recent years. Okay.
Do you know what? I thought I'd seen it and then I was confusing it for Gone Girl. That's what I thought.
I just said Gone Girl.
Yeah. What it is Gone Girl.
It is Gone Girl. What did I just
Girl
say?
On the Train.
Oh.
I thought it was Girl on the Train, sorry. And then I was like, I've seen that.
I mean,
that.
They are two best-selling crime mystery novels with the word girl in the title. Easily confused.
Of the last few years.
And who's the author of Girl on the Train? I think it's a similar name, isn't it?
John's going to look that up, but it's not Gillian Flynn. Gillian Flynn wrote Gone Girl, which was the subject of one of my favourite films of recent years, of which The Girl on the Train is not. It's fine, perfectly decent film, that is. But Gone Girl is brilliant, with Ben Affleck, directed by David Fincher. Absolute classic. This is her novel turned in. She helped adapt it for an eight-part HBO series, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who directed Big Little Lies, which was kind of last year's big HBO
visual treat.
You know, 7-8-part serial. This is an 8-part serial. It's kind of got a lot in common, and it stars Amy Adams, who plays a big city newspaper reporter in St. Louis, Missouri, with a history of psychological issues, many, many psychological issues. She's sent back to her hometown by her boss, her newspaper boss, who also is clearly trying to help her get back into kind of professional life because she's had big, big issues in recent times.
She likes the drink.
She likes a drink. There will be flashbacks to her, not to spoil it, in traumatic times. And how she dealt with that. I think that I've seen 7 episodes, by the way. So I'm trying to remember.
Oh, wow.
Not to reveal too much.
I'm so jealous.
Yes. For the record, I've only done 1.
Fair enough.
Yeah, me too.
Fair enough. That's what a normal person would do. So she's been sent by her boss to investigate murders that have been going on in her small town community where she was brought up by her mother, played by Patricia Clarkson, who's quite a piece of work. And her mother kind of is the richest woman in the town. She's got a pig farming business and she kind of employs all the kind of locals. And she's got an extraordinarily harsh relationship with her daughter. And she's not happy that the daughter's come back to the town to kind of expose the dark underbelly and to report on it for the newspaper.
She's very controlling.
Very controlling, very manipulative. Meanwhile, there's a detective who's also an outsider who arrives to investigate the murders because, frankly, no one really trusts the police chief, the old school police chief, to do it all himself. So they kind of have to work together. And it's a kind of, as much I would say, a psychological thriller about what's going on in Amy Adams' character's mind and how she's dealing with what's happened in her past, as well as an investigation into these murders that are happening now in this small town in Missouri. Kay Ribeiro, what do you reckon?
I absolutely bloody love this. I think it's fantastic. It's one of the best things I've seen this year, I think. All of it is fantastic. I mean, it's visually, it's very lavishly filmed. All the actors are great, the performances. But I think Amy Adams is just exceptional as this tortured soul. And she gives such a densely layered performance that I just think she's one of these characters, a bit like Sega from The Bridge, where you could just watch her for like 10 series, you probably wouldn't get to the bottom of what's motivating her, what's gone on in her past to make her how she is, because obviously so much traumatic stuff has happened to her. But I just think it's brilliant, and I think everyone's going to be talking about it. I loved it.
John, you will be talking about it now, I hope. Otherwise, it would be weird podcast.
Living up to silent John.
Do you agree?
Yes, I think it's going to be an agreeance all around somehow. What Kay said, one of the problems is when you agree with someone, you worry that you're just going to start regurgitating the exact same stuff. But yeah, exactly what Kay said about the way it's like, it is in a weird way reminiscent of Big Little Lies in the way that it's filmed. It's much more adult, if you could say so, I'd say, than Big Little Lies. Mm. But in terms of the way that it's filmed, that it's nothing spectacular is happening, but the way it's filmed, it feels quite cinematic and big. Mm. And in the first episode, stuff happens, don't get me wrong, but not a lot.
Mm.
Yet somehow, like, the incredible performance from Amy Adams and just the little teases and bits of information that they give you is just enough to make you really care about the characters and want to find out what's happening. It's an amazing, like, first episode to just get you hooked and care about characters and make you want to keep watching them by not doing a lot.
It's a setup episode, isn't it? Yeah. But there's just so many hints at like this dark past that, you know, her mother, why is she so
horrible.
Angry? Yeah, angry and like nasty to this daughter. What's brought about this drinking, like, and obviously it's glimpses into her past. But also there's this half-sister called Emma, played by Eliza Scanlon, who's also very intriguing. There's something not quite right about her as well.
Oh, God, yeah. And it's damaged.
Everyone's very damaged. Damaged goods.
Everyone's drinking. This is what, again, to say again, I've watched 7 out of the 8 episodes.
Show off.
I'm showing off. Just because I'm obsessed with it. And annoyingly, I'm so stupid because I knew that they're not, obviously, the last episode, which includes the reveal of what. Yeah, they won't give me that. So I'm going to have to wait about 10 weeks now because this starts next Monday.
Tactical error.
To find out what the hell. Or I could just read the book. I haven't read the book, by the way. But I think, so this goes, I'm looking at this, I agree, I think it's darker. I mean, I know people say the word dark all the time. It's literally darker, isn't it? The Big Little Lies was sunny and Californian. And kind of quite funny, even though it's dealing with big issues like abuse, you know, spousal abuse, remember? And all of that. It was a lot of wry, funny stuff about like almost social satire of these posh women, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
You're looking at me like you don't agree
with
that.
No, I thought
funny.
You said, no, I mean, it wasn't like a lol fest, but yeah,
no,
I see what you mean.
Wryly,
it was a satire. Yeah.
It was wryly amusing, a lot of it, as well as being, you know, and the way, so, but I think the John Mark Valley thing, he actually directed that series, as you were saying, it's this structure, this flashback structure is so clever where, he's constantly showing tiny little glimpses, sometimes literally like a second of something that happened years ago or something happened in the past somehow, mainly with Amy Adams' character. And these glimpses carry all the way through. You get to see more and more of what's happened to her in the past and these little moments. And he did that all the way through in Big Little Lies as well. In fact, Big Little Lies had flashes forward and flashes backwards.
Yeah.
But he does it so well. And I think he's absolute master of the material, but equally, Amy Adams is incredible. And that relationship between Amy Adams and Patricia Clarkson, the mother-daughter thing, is one of the most... It's so entertaining because it's so ridiculous how horrible the mother is to the daughter. And by the way, it gets worse.
Oh, really?
Like, it gets even... It carries on...
What is her problem?
Relentless. Well, you do find out. I mean, I've reached episode 7 and you kind of pretty much find out what the psychological reasons for that is.
Really?
Yeah, you do, yeah.
There's anything with spoiling. Amy Adams, there's just like a rawness about
it. Oh my God, she's totally damaged. But what's brilliant is that she's also incredibly, like she's harsh to people and very blunt, almost in a saga, Nora, as you were saying, almost some things in common.
Mm.
But somehow incredibly likable, like you want to spend time with her. I can't remember how much there was in the first episode, but she develops more of a friendship with the detective.
Yeah, so that kind of starts in the first episode.
Yeah, the two outsiders bond.
Yeah.
Because they're both being regarded by the locals as like snobs and, you know, people who shouldn't be poking their nose in. And their bond over that is brilliantly done as well. It is. I think it's up there. I think it's better than Big Little Lies.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
And you've got...
Yeah, I agree.
And we've already got... you know, this year Patrick Melrose, A Very English Scandal. I'm saying it's in that. It's up there. It might even be. I don't know. It's just an incredible example of, as you say, cinematic television. It's brilliant.
It's
5
gripping.
Stars.
It is gripping. It's a 5 stars from me.
Well, John Dan.
I was going to say 4.5, and I feel guilty now.
No, you say 4.5.
Say 4.5.
You are hard to please, John Dan.
That's based on the first episode.
Fair enough. Oh, yeah. I mean, I've literally watched 7 hours.
He's only giving it 4.5 because it wasn't a podcast.
True. As I may have mentioned, I've watched 7 hours of it. It's starting next Monday on Sky Atlantic and Now TV, and it's such a big deal for them. They're doing that thing they do with Westworld and Game of Thrones where they're showing it live as it goes out in America
at
2 in the morning, simulcast, or if you want to stay up normal time, watch it at 9 o'clock in the evening. And it is phenomenal. Moving on to Dicta. Crime reporter.
We need to have some clarification of this. I don't know how we can
Dicta. I'm just being silly, calling it, overpronouncing it. They say a name. It's the name of the main character, Dicta Svensson.
Yeah.
Played by Eben Hiely.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah, not really. And they just kind of say, oh, hi, Dicta. All right, Dicta.
Okay.
Dicta.
Oh, tug. Tug.
Who wants to explain what the hell this is about? I'm going for Kay.
Yeah. All right. Well, what I'll say is I haven't watched any of the previous series, so...
Well, we're all in that boat.
Yeah. Oh, are we? Okay, fine. All right. So Dicta, or Dicty as I'm calling her, has... you get the impression, and listeners, if you've seen the past, I'm sure this is right? but she obviously wasn't that keen to settle down before, because you get that impression that...
Oh, she's in the previous... Yeah.
Yes, yeah, so yeah. She's now settling down with Beau, played by Dar Salim, who was in Below the Surface, which we reviewed. Do you remember?
Yeah, of course.
He was one of the hostages who was taken on the train.
Yep, yep, yep.
Anyway, so they have just... John Dunn's looking confused.
Oh, no, I was just saying he, it sounds like he's getting a raw old time of it in
yeah,
all the
he's,
shows.
Yeah, he's having a bad time. He's a professional
He loves
hostage.
Being hostage.
Yeah. Anyway, they
Spoiler
get...
alert.
In the first episode...
For what you're about to say.
Yeah. They get married in the first episode, and life seems to be good. She seems to have finally like got to grips with this domestic lifestyle, that, and she's finally thinking, right, this is me done. She's given up her job as a journalist. She's going to write a book. And then, God... Sucks to be her. The next day, her now husband, who's gone off on a mission, a photo assignment to Lebanon, doesn't come back, right? She's calling him. He says, yeah, yeah, he's getting the next plane. His plane's been cancelled. He's coming back. And then he doesn't come back. And as the episode continues, we kind of find out that he has been taken hostage, and it's the race against time to try and generate the money. As always, a bit like Below the Surface, where they had the exact same concept.
Wow.
Yeah.
Johnny John Dan.
Boydie.
JD.
Is this up your... I know you're a fan of... We're going to go move on to The Bridge later when we do our spoilers, but I know you're a fan of that Scandinavian crime drama. How does this Scandinavian crime drama hit you?
It's probably the first time... I don't watch a lot of Scandinavian dramas, so I probably had an unfair idea of what Scandinavian drama is going to be like.
Are you going to be out of order about them?
No, I love it. Ones I've seen, I think, are phenomenal.
Oh,
and
fine.
I thought this was good. I'm not negative against it. It's just I think because of stuff like The Bridge, I'm expecting everything to be so much darker and bleaker. And this one... My first note was, it's tonally odd. And I don't think maybe that's because I'm not used to watching the kind of 7-8 o'clock dramas. I'm usually the person watching the, you know, the 9-10 p.m. ones, which are... Do you see what I mean?
No, what do you mean? So do you just mean that, like, it's because it's not dark enough?
It's not dark. There's like at the beginning, it's tonally odd because they're like cracking jokes, and they've... The opening credits are like the level of, like, they're like Hollyoaks.
Dude, I've got a whole section. I just want to, yeah, I've got a lot to say about these.
Yeah, it's quite kind of 90s, isn't it? The way it's filmed and the way it's presented. I think that's one of the issues.
And
it
then
feels
you're dealing
very
with
old
like
school.
Lebanon and terrorists and hostages, and you think, just for me, that jarred slightly.
It's a bit 24.
I know what you mean, because there's a young... in the scene set in the newspaper where she's trying to, she goes to see the editor to help, you know, free their colleague. There's this woman whose hair
is like Amy Winehouse.
Exactly. There's some incredible hair throughout the whole show, by the way. It's an incredible haircut. So I know that's not an important and profound criticism, but the one who looks like Amy Winehouse is like chuckling all the time about this very serious situation, which is quite funny. I thought it was funny, but you're right. It is totally weird, isn't it? There's people are kind of quipping a lot. And it's definitely not, and I know I said this last week about our last week's Water Presents show that we did, but I'm finding it hard not to say it. So it's
compared
my honest...
Compared to The Bridge.
Not even in terms of the dialogue or the characterization or the mystery, just in the way it's filmed. Like, this is very quite basic, isn't it, the way it's filmed? Just lower
it
budget.
Is.
The Bridge is so beautiful. Every shot is so fantastic and it's so atmospheric. This has no atmosphere.
Yeah.
It's fairly straightforwardly shot. It feels like a kind of episode of Sweeney to me, like back in the 70s.
Okay, so this is why, right, I wish I'd watched the first and second series because, Steph's really,
people are really
raves
fond
about
of
this.
It, yeah.
People rave about this all the time. And I believe it is, like, and based on this episode, it is good. It's good enough, do you know what I mean? But it's not, when you... I think when I watch it, I unfairly compare it to The Bridge because that is just now the benchmark for everything. And I don't think that's necessarily fair. But while it is good, the opening credits and the music within is so naff, right?
Naff, that's the word.
It's totally naff, and it reminds me of, do you remember Family Affairs?
I do.
Right, it's a soap on, was it
Watched
Channel 5?
Watched every episode, yeah.
It reminds me of that, and I think it really does it a disservice because it makes it seem... naff, and I don't think it is. It's a good drama, but it's just not to The Bridge standard.
Interestingly, I did read that. So it's shown here. It's showing here from next Friday on the More 4 channel, and it's in five parts, and they're like 5-hour-long episodes. And interestingly, in Denmark, where it's shown, where it's made and shown, they show it in like little half-hour episodes. So it's quite an interesting format.
Yeah, but what's the reason behind the NAF opening credits?
I think the whole... on one level... So the only explanation... I think they're trying to be slightly less portentous, to use that word, than something like the bridge. I've used that word. Do you know what I mean? Less kind of... Not everything has to be big and lavish and... You know, every show has to be incredible, and not every. And so it feels like, you know, their ambition is smaller, but still.
But I think it diminishes its value by having such enough music. I think it's making it soapy when it's not.
No, I agree.
I actually think perhaps the reason they've put them in hour-long episodes is so you don't think they're soapy.
Yeah.
Because
if you did see hours, you'd think, oh, I'm not sure. Yeah. Whereas an hour-long feels.
Yeah,
prestige.
Without doubt. That's why I mentioned it. Yeah. Well, Dick D, crime reporter. How many stars are you giving it, Kay?
I'm giving it 4 stars. I think it's good. I want to go back and watch first and second series.
Jonathan?
3.5. And also just to say, I wonder if Steph will say otherwise on a future episode, but you haven't seen previous series, I think by the time this episode's finished, you're actually pretty up to date with what each character is and their kind of relationships. So if you did for some reason just want to start here, I think it's not completely confusing.
When I was referring to that, I was just saying because I was describing their relationship, and I thought for anyone who's actually watched it, it's obvious that
I'm going to give it 3.5 stars as well. Walter Presents : Dick D, crime reporter.
Dick D
is on More 4 from next Friday, which is the 13th of July, Friday the 13th at the 9 p.m. Finally, it is Picnic at Hanging Rock. So I'm the only one who's seen the film Picnic at Hanging Rock, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, just going back to something. No? Did you ever find out who the author was of that? It's really annoying me.
Yes, I did. Sorry. Oh. The author of Girl on the Train is Paula Hawkins.
Exactly. It's exactly the same.
Gideon Flynn. Paula Hawkins.
Very, very similar.
Which one I said just then, because they sound so similar.
It's like...
Anyway, just to bring us up to date, we're now doing Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Sorry.
Which is based on a classic novel, Australian novel. It's turned into an absolutely brilliant film, directed by Peter Weir in 1974-5. John, would you like to assail this televisual artifact?
Yeah, but I'm worried I'm just going to read out the official blurb.
I'm giving you an official blurb.
In the final decade of the 19th century, beautiful and mysterious widow Hester Appleyard, brackets Natalie Dormer, arrives in Australia, haunted by her secret past. Do you want me to go any further into it?
Yes. Because that's not going to be enough to entice people.
Paying in cash for an isolated mansion out in the bush, she establishes a school for young ladies, and 6 years later, Appleyard College is a success. An enigmatic headmistress, something haunts Hester. Is it the bush, dangerous or untamed?
Oh my god, it makes it sound like it's
loads of stuff about
her
dangerous
bush
and untamed bush.
When I first read it, you're reading in that voice.
I didn't watch the second episode. Is that all about that?
Her bush features heavily, yeah.
Steady. But what the big thing that happens is they go for a picnic at Bloody Hanging Rock, which is a real huge big rock in the outback in Australia, and they disappear. Some of them disappear. Some of the women, some of the young ladies in this school, and some of their tutors.
Yeah.
Go missing, and the whole thing is what the hell has happened to these women, and what does it all mean? Kay.
Yes. Right. Okay. I've got to say, I didn't warm to this in the same way that I imagine you guys did, and you know, it's one of those ones. No, it's
never
one,
imagined, never assumed. Never,
I have assumed.
Don't make an ass out of you. Never do that.
No, but I just know that this is obviously one that I'm sure everyone's going to love, but. What I liked about it is that I did think Natalie Dormer's character is very intriguing because she's as repelling as she is appealing. Like, there's something about her that's intriguing, yet she's quite a repellent character. Like, she's obviously like the other character in... what was it we just talked about? I can't even remember.
Victor?
No, the one that's...
Shot Objects?
Yes. She's obviously got, you know, some traumas that have happened to her. Yeah. You know, she comes and she's like... She's a widow. She's got stuff going on, and she's really, really harsh with the girls. She wants them to be a certain way, you know. In the first episode, there's a character called Miranda who's very headstrong, and there's an incident in a barn when a young soldier tries to take advantage and she impales his foot with a pitchfork, and it's horrendous. And rather than sympathizing with her, Hester's like really furious with her that she's let their standards slip, and she's left herself open to, you know, people saying stuff about her reputation. And I just think, so obviously it is intriguing, like, why she's such a bitch. But I don't know. I just Yeah, the B word. But I don't know. Gothic thrillers aren't my thing, so...
Oh, what have you got against gothic thrillers?
I don't know, I just didn't...
Is that why you turned around to me in the middle of watching the show and said, is this a gothic thriller? And when I said, and I said, kind of. I didn't really know how to respond to that. And then you then decided you didn't like it because you don't like gothic thrillers.
Yeah, I didn't
know. So are you telling me?
Put it like this. At the end of the episode, when they go down to the rock and, you know, something... How would you describe that? Is it like otherworldly? I don't even know.
Yeah. Otherworldly is good.
The official blurb says something unthinkable happens.
Okay. Something unthinkable happens. Mm. And while it's intriguing, I don't feel compelled to watch, find out what it is. I'm going to let one of you watch and tell me.
Thanks for that. Thanks for letting us watch.
Cheers.
Kay is assuming that you are going to love it there or like it.
No, I assume you're going to love it.
Oh, you said both of us.
You did.
No, you're backtracking. It's a backtrack.
I think John will as well. I'll stand by it.
I'm going to love it.
I think you'll think it's good, really good.
For the record, I think the last time I was on here, we did a period drama starring one of the Game of Thrones cast.
Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think we did. What was that?
The one about the 5th of November.
Yeah. Do you remember?
Oh, God.
What was that?
Yeah, yeah.
None of us can remember. It was
with Jon Snow, yeah.
Mm.
Guy Fawkes.
Yes.
It wasn't called that.
No, it was
Fawkes.
Fawkes. No, it wasn't called that either.
It was about one of his crew,
yeah.
Wasn't it? It wasn't about Fawkes himself.
No, exactly, yeah.
Oh, yeah. What was that called? Okay, I'm going to look it up.
I didn't love it.
Yeah, John, joining my bus.
So what I did, I agree with you. I thought Natalie Dormer was great and intriguing. I don't know if this is getting into spoiler territory, but she seems to have an internal monologue that's a cockney.
She does. That's right at the beginning.
That was weird.
In the voiceover.
Slightly weird.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Yeah, it's a bit weird.
There were some really interestingly filmed bits. So there was some like really...
Gunpowder.
Yes.
Guy Fawkes.
So the entire first sequence is broadly filmed behind Natalie Dormer and it's all done in one take. There is some like quite shaky handycam stuff. There's a sequence that starts with the camera upside down.
Oh, yeah.
They use these bright pink title cards between sequences.
I wasn't into that so much, but...
They have modern music as opposed to a normal period drama that would have. And I think some of those choices are really interesting. I don't know. I would agree. I'm not sure about the pink title cards, but there was some of the, and I'm not even sure about the modern music, but some of the filming and kind of production choices were interesting.
He's really having to scrape the barrel of some production choices.
Well, no, I just want to tell the listener, after John used the word interesting then, his face literally did like a kind of, I don't know, what was he described? Like a, I don't know, grimace. Yeah. Grimace, that's what it was.
I love that everyone's getting an insight to John now.
Interesting in a bad way. Yeah.
And I thought it was, I didn't quite get it. At the end, I wasn't sure what was happening and not in a, as we were describing with sharp objects.
Not in a you're being stupid
way. Not in sharp objects where it was like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. I want to know why that weird thing's happening. I didn't think, oh, I want to know what's happening. I was thinking, I don't get it. And so I think it did actually jar with me as equally as it did UK.
John, I'm happy about this. We've made up now.
I don't like being mean about stuff, though.
It's not mean. There's going to be a lot of people who
the
will
young
love
cast.
It.
The young cast, all of the cast were great, actually. Not just Natalie Dormer. I thought
Samara Weaving plays Irma, the sophisticated heiress. Madeline Madden plays the whip smart Marion. Lily Sullivan plays rebellious Tomboy Miranda. They're all great. I agree.
I did like Miranda.
And young orphan Sarah played by Inez Curro. I enjoyed it more than you two.
Okay,
but it is weird. This is what I would say about it. And I've watched episode 2, so I've got slightly more of a handle on it. Your face. Kate's face. Now, I love describing the face. Kate's face, you bothered watching episode 2. It's literally like written all over her face. Are you mad?
Sorry.
But it does tonally, and I think I've said this before on this podcast. Do we call it a show?
I don't know.
That when people say stuff is tonally all over the place, I find that quite an annoying criticism, because that's fine. If you want to be tonally all over the place, sometimes it's okay.
Yeah.
In this, it is weird. So... As you say, the opening where the voiceover from Natalie Dormer, when she does a bit of Cockney, she's clearly alluding to the fact that she's changed completely. She's pretending to be this demure widow to buy this big house to turn it into this girls' school. And she's got like all secrets from her past or whatever that two of the girls have unearthed, by the way, clearly in some hidden tin. There's a whole thing going on.
Yeah, this whole...
And she punishes them for
that's
that.
That's why I keep my secrets.
So there's that. Yeah, you've got to keep it in a tin, in a little hidden tin. There's that weird voiceover bit. And the end of the first episode, there's the dream. We haven't mentioned the dream sequence in black and white.
Oh, yeah.
Which is extraordinary. That's right. Did you get that photo?
John's blacked it out.
I did watch the whole of it.
The bizarre dream sequence in black.
She's asleep in bed and she's just...
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
It's a dream sequence in black and white that is utterly preposterous. But I mean, it's a dream. It's fine. People's dreams are preposterous, but it's completely like out of nowhere. And you're like, oh my God, what's going on there? Right, it's a dream. It's in black and white. Fine. And you're right with all the, there's incredibly lush use of color in the scenes shot in the rural areas, in the outback next to Hanging Rock itself. But it is all over the place a bit. And
it's all
to
over
the point
joint,
where Natalie Dormer's being very, you know, I'm this horrible, nasty woman who's going to abuse these kids, basically, these poor girls. And the girls are being very naturalistic, I thought. But anyway, bottom line is, I could go on about it a lot. I do have issues with it. I think it's, and then I watched the second issue, and the second episode calms down a bit. Okay. So it's weird in a way that they've gone so full out with all the different styles and looks visually and tonally and in the script in the first episode. And then episode two kind of settles down once you know that they've all got to find out what happened to these poor missing girls. But what the problem, two problems for me is, one, we're reviewing it in the same week. So I enjoyed it. And I am going to carry on watching it. I did carry on watching it. So you're laughing.
I'm laughing because you said, oh, we'll find out what happens to those girls. And I was thinking, don't care.
Right, fine. But the two problems for me, which I have to admit, you know, not the fault of the show, but of just how I feel right now, is the film is absolutely effing brilliant still. And I watched a bit of it last night to double check. I was thinking, am I remembering this film? So I cranked it up. And it's so, that the tone of the film is completely consistent. And it maintains this unbelievable feeling of dread and kind of overheated, this atmosphere is incredible. So clearly what they've decided to do in this is not do that, is do something different. That's admirable. But that's, for me, it isn't as good as the film. And then B, in the same week as Sharp Objects, which is so, as you said, so brilliantly directed and so relentlessly compelling, this does feel a bit more all over the place. But I'm still going to give it 4 stars.
How many stars are you giving? 3.5.
John Dan.
3 for me, please.
Picnic at Hanging Rock is on BBC Two next Wednesday, the 11th of July at 9:05 p.m.
Interesting.
9:05?
Yeah, I mean,
what's
if
that
you
5 minutes about, eh?
You're going to have to wait
making
5 minutes.
Making a cup of tea.
So you're going to have to wait 5 bloody minutes. But what I will say is, before we go on to our final spoiler special section about The Bridge, is that it's a pretty good week for new drama, considering we're in the high of the summer. You know, usually it shows you that TV now is an all year
usually
round.
Usually it's silly season, isn't it? Especially season. With football on.
You've got Sharp Objects, one of the things of the year. Anyway, now we are going to, listeners, discuss the final episode ever of The Bridge that went out last Friday, including spoilers. Like, we're going to talk about who did it and stuff and what happens to all the people in it. And if you don't want to know that, if you haven't yet had a chance to watch it, stop listening now. If you've stayed with us.
I like your dramatic pause.
Well, it's got to be user-friendly.
Yeah. Imagine you're, like, ruffling through your pockets to get it.
Yeah, exactly.
And imagine
this bit's helping it. Yeah.
Knowing UK, you'd straight away have just screamed the killer. So
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Furious. Exactly. Me and John Dan really not having a good episode together.
The killer. Yeah, it is. Yeah, of course it's a killer. What am I on about?
I mean, serial killer.
Serial killer. Yeah.
Now, luckily enough, I think we're all huge fans of The Bridge, aren't we?
Yeah.
Like, Kay and I went to see the thing at the BFI, the launch of this series at BFI, and the writer was, I think we mentioned this before in this podcast, the writer and stars were there. You, John, I know, were furious and jealous that we'd had a chance to see this before you had.
Live but it. I gave him a little
toy car.
Yeah, I gave him a toy car, Sega's car. Gifted it to John.
So I guess where to begin? I mean, first of all, in general, this is the last ever episode, unless they revive in a few years' time, which I think is a stick possibility.
Do you think?
Please.
Yeah, I think so. I just think,
I don't think they should. I think they should just leave it now.
The first spoiler fact is,
okay,
no one dies. No one of the major characters dies. So they could have killed her off. They could have killed off Saga or Henrik. They both survive. And that ending is, she goes back to the bridge where it all started. And she's been, she had those sessions with her shrink, with the psychologist. Mm. And the psychologist kind of pointed out that maybe the reason she's become this detective, trying to solve these things and trying to help people in that way, is because of the guilt she feels about what happened to her sister. And there's this whole thing about, you find out that her mother had that syndrome. What's it called?
Munchausen.
Thank you. Munchausen's by proxy or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so she feels suddenly free. There's a sense of freedom. She's on that bridge. She's like, all right, give. And she throws her police badge in the river. And it's like,
so poetic.
So poetic. Giving up being a cop. And I thought that was a brilliant ending. But equally, in a few years' time, they could bring her back.
Case that's so important that she
exactly,
has to
exactly. It'll be amazing if
well,
they...
Well, first of all, how is she going to fish that police badge out of the, out of the water?
I think they can find her a new one.
Mm. But she wouldn't want a new one. She would want the old one.
She needs to get a new photo of herself. It'll be fine. Mm. But what's she going to do now? She's going to just, like, you know, have fun with life. Anyway, I thought it was a very clever kind of, because apart from the fact that we'll talk about the solving the crimes, it was an incredibly satisfying ending for her personally, and I thought that was great.
And actually, that's what I cared about most. I have to say, by the end of it, I didn't really care about the serial killer. Right. All I wanted to know is like how her story was going to end. And because I really loved the relationship with her and Hendrik. So I was like, how is this going to play out? Would I believe if they were like happily ensconced at the end, would that satisfy me? Would I think actually that's not really how I see her story being because of how she is?
And that would have been the kind of cliched resolution.
It would be very easy.
Because all the way through, it was like, can they resolve away in their relationship? Can she have a relationship with a normal relationship with a man in that way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really like the fact that I think it was completely believable. Like, I think if she hadn't had these counselling sessions, to me, it wouldn't have been believable that she would have come round to the position where she would be giving up her job and stuff like that, because I just don't think her relationship with Hendrik would have been enough, and she would have kind of she would have realized, you know, all of that stuff on her own. And so actually it was it was perfect, that method of having the counselor.
Are you in agreement, John? Are you happy with the way that she threw her police?
I liked that. Yeah, I thought that was good.
You're not happy that she's given up her,
well, it's like watching that show end for me was like it was like finishing a really, really good book, and you think, oh, now I've got to read a new book and I've got to get to know new characters. do you know I was enjoying being in that world so much, now I have to go get a new kind of drama, maybe Sharp Objects, but you know it, I genuinely, because it's for me personally, over the last few years it's been like an absolute television highlight every time it's been on, even when some of the elements have potentially gone slightly preposterous. I've always still loved the show. In terms of the crime, were you guys happy with all that stuff? I know Kay said that she didn't really care by the end of it.
Well, what I liked about it was that, as I mentioned this last week, was that I loved how you thought that, I think if I'm right in saying, at the end of Seven, the penultimate episode, we saw the woman.
The assistant
to the guy who was married to one of the victims.
Oh, yeah.
That she was, when she started chasing after the two girls, because they...
Which was really terrifying. I was actually really scared for
them. She's scared. She's just like this super, super assassin woman.
Yeah.
Who was unveiled as the perpetrator.
Yeah.
And so at the end of episode 7, the beginning of episode 8, and there was a whole big episode 8 started, I think I'm right in saying, it's all a blur now, weeks ago, with that tense scene where she goes to the house.
Yes.
And all of that.
She tases Sega.
And they sort it out.
She shoots Sega. She tases the girls, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah. Sorry,
oh, yeah, she shoots. Yeah, but she's got the bulletproof
Sega,
left,
but it's all fine. And they capture her, and you think it's been solved. But then there's another half hour to go of that episode when you think everything's been solved. And that's when Sega suddenly realised, and she also has of course solved the mystery of Henrik's daughter's disappearing. There's that she solved, which I don't know if that is what you're alluding to when you're saying it, preposterous. Like, it's slightly like she suddenly decides she's going to solve that crime and does it in about 10 minutes. I mean, that it does happen, but I went along with it.
Nothing is beyond her abilities.
I went along with it, but what I did really like about that final episode was how you thought everything had been resolved pretty much in the first half of the episode, and then suddenly they did a reverse ferret and that it hadn't still been solved, and then the guy in the wheelchair ended up standing up.
Oh my gosh.
And attacking.
Did you hate that bit, John? It's pulling a face.
So I am nitpicking because it is like my favorite show.
Yeah.
I worry that man in wheelchair doesn't need wheelchair is a bit of a
Little Britain.
Cheap. Yeah, it is a bit Little Britain. It's a bit of a cheap way out. And I think feasibly there is a way they could have had all those crimes be committed by either the woman or him still wheelchair bound.
Well, that's a very good point. I didn't know why. I was going to ask this point. Why did he need to not be wheelchair bound plot wise, because she was definitely involved, right?
Yeah. I think it's for the shock, isn't it?
She was completely right. So it was a gratuitous moment, really, because I thought the whole thing was going to be she's the physical, he's the mastermind, if you like, and then she carries stuff
evil
out
genius.
Physically. Yeah. But then they had this, as you said, rather needless bit where he stands up like Little Britain.
Do you know what? I hadn't thought of it before.
Like Lou and Andy. And it was semi-comical. It was literally like, you're
standing up until this point, I actually quite enjoyed that moment. Do you know what I liked as well? You know the bit where she's figured something out. Oh, yeah, she's figured out about her mum definitely having Munchausen by proxy, and she phones Hendrik, who's in the hospital, and he's like, look, I can't talk. And she's like, oh, I just wanted to tell you. And he's really quite short with her, and he puts the phone down. And then because she says, oh, I just wanted to tell someone who's important to me what I found out. And then she leaves, and she goes to the prison. And I don't know if I'm the only one. I thought she was going to go see Martin.
Yeah, I think that was a fake out. I was.
That's what I thought. But I said that to Boyd, and he didn't think that. But I was like, but I love that. I love that. That's what that you're led to believe, and then the twist.
No, I really like that bit as well. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I completely loved. I think as finales go, like you're talking about, you know, final episodes of The Sopranos and Breaking Bad, all these classic shows. And for me, you know, in some ways, The Bridge is the Scandinavian equivalent of those iconic, long-running series. I thought it was incredibly effective and satisfying.
Yeah.
Before the episode started, I was hoping there was going to be, even if it was a single shot,
a nuclear explosion,
something to do with Martin. But in hindsight, now that the episode happened, I think if you put Martin in it, it suggests that the two seasons with Henrik are less.
So Martin was the original partner in series one and two,
played by like a really really famous Scandinavian actor. Grumpy, who decided he didn't like it.
He had autistic creative differences with the showrunners. Yeah, and left.
What a fool.
I know what you mean. Yeah, but that would have been almost even more gratuitous than the guy standing up in the wheelchair.
Yeah,
but
I think so.
They had a couple of people come back, which I thought was good, didn't they, from previous,
the old police chief
days.
In the flashback episode.
Yeah. And also the head of, the physical head of his chops.
Yeah, exactly. Horrendous.
What's his name? Her mentor, the police officer.
I can't think for the life of me.
Hans?
Yes, Hans.
Yeah.
And I think her finding out that the daughter was somehow connected to the crime that they are solving that season.
Yes. Big coincidence there.
It was... small world.
Yeah,
that's the only thing.
No, completely. That's another thing. Yeah, is that I was like trying to work out the way where it wasn't just incredible coincidence, but it was an incredible coincidence, wasn't it? Yeah, that these two things were linked. Yeah, absolutely massive.
Which is fine, you know. It's a drama. Like.
And I didn't feel. I have one more thing to say. Sorry, which you just reminded me of that whole strand, that this weird village where run
like
by this woman.
Thing,
it was like cult, but they didn't really explain what that was, did they? Unless I missed something. I suddenly thought, have I missed where they explained?
No, it was just a way of explain, like, you know, where his family had gone.
I know, but what is this cult village? Like in the beginning, the first few episodes, when they were setting up, you definitely like led to believe there was something quite
nefarious.
Yeah, nefarious or something not quite right about this. Well, and then you just like.
And the son, you know, the son of the woman, the domestic abuse storyline, that didn't really.
No,
I think Hans Rosenfeld did a fantastic job, the writer.
You're the writer.
Oh, I thought you meant Hans, the police chief. He did a great job of as a head.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hans is the writer who also wrote Marcella. It was better than the ending of Marcella. Mm. Marcella, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I remember that ending.
Oh my God.
See, I just reminded
you. Oh God, that is ridiculous.
But that will be coming back.
The last,
when Marcella
becomes
the Joker.
I actually really liked Marcella, even though it got a bit ridiculous.
No, I did as well.
But the last 6 minutes.
Yeah. Are we going into, is this a spoiler Marcella?
I think we've already done that.
All right, we have, just making sure.
No, we've done it as well.
I'm just comparing it because he's the same writer. Yeah
so compared
but
to that.
But it shows how he loves a bold, you know, end. Set piece moment. Yeah. So
good
like
for him.
The grand standing up with the wheelchair. Oh, totally, yeah. And I mean, it's great. And I remember finally, what I was going to say was, I remember when we went to that Q&A at the BFI where she and him were there and they both said, when the people were asking, oh, you know, are you happy with the ending? They both said they knew what the ending was going to be, presumably, as in her going to touch the bridge and throwing, giving up being a policewoman. They knew right at the beginning of the series. And I thought, yeah, clearly that was very clever.
And they also said that the last scene between Henrik and Sega was really emotional. Yeah. Like, they found it completely emotional.
It was really. It was very, very clever.
Unlike Kay, though, if it does come back in 2 years, I'll be happy. Really happy.
No.
I'll be fine with that.
This is my note to Hans. Please leave it where it is.
Send him if he's listening. Hans on the ground, hog.
or he makes another series and you just don't watch it.
That's a good answer. That's
no,
a good
John Dan.
No, she likes to control what's going on. She can't just stay away from controlling. Like the mother
like
in Sharp Objects. Kay is the Sharp Objects mother of the Unmissable.
I'll be a Sharp Object in a moment if
and
we don't wrap this up.
On that note, it's late on Friday afternoon. We've all got homes to go to. And it's a goodbye from me.
It's a goodbye from me.
It's a goodbye from me.
And special thanks to Johnny for covering.
Cheers, John Dan.
Steph Senior. He'll be back next week.